Mi'kmaq, wisdom includes the ability to see the big picture and the power to sustain. This is William Evans, and we're shifting gears. Our guest today has been attentive to the big picture for many years, and she understands how some chemicals can disrupt our ability to sustain life and health. I'm speaking with Theo Colburn. Theo is the founder of the Endocrine Disruption Exchange in Paonia, Colorado. Welcome, Theo.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Tell us about the Endocrine Disruption Exchange.
Well, we're a small nonprofit that grew out of the work that I had been doing in Washington, D.C. for the previous 15 years, that when I injured my spine, couldn't go back to Washington to work, and some of my staff pitched in, packed up everything, and helped us move everything out here to Colorado, where we're carrying on the same work. We focus on chemicals that at low levels of exposure, and especially during prenatal days, that period when an individual is in the womb, can be affected by these chemicals. And of course, our work keeps expanding more and more. We find more and more chemicals are endocrine disruptors. But it's a whole new field of how to look at health, actually taking a health-based approach to do the research and find out what these chemicals are doing. Very unlike the toxicological approaches we used in the past, where we dosed adult animals with high doses to see how much we could feed them before they became ill.
So you and I lived for many years hearing the advertising tell us better living through chemistry, and we now know the truth is more complicated than that. Some chemicals are beneficial. Other chemicals in proper dosage are therapeutic, but quite a few chemicals are hazardous or fatal to ingest, inhale, or even touch.
You are so correct. I think of the ads everyone's seeing on television today. Even now, when a chemical or a pharmaceutical is advertised, they spend more time telling you the side effects of that particular product or drug than they do telling you about the product. Which should make everyone realize that chemicals can have a lot of effects. And when corporations submitted permits or applications to the EPA and other agencies to use particular chemicals, they only looked at, they quote, cancer, outright convulsions, obvious birth defects, weight change, organ weight change, and mutations, and that was about it. And when you listen to those list side effects that each chemical that we're trying to sell to doctors, the doctors will prescribe them for you, could have many, many more effects than just that one effect that they're selling that product on.
Well, and part of the reason they disclose that information is that they have some responsibility and liability.
Oh, certainly. Yes, very much so.
You came to Colorado and lived on a ranch with your husband, raising children and purebred sheep, as well as working as a relief pharmacist traveling to Carbondale and Gunnison and Delta. What did you notice during that time?
Well, it was interesting. I worked mainly in Paonia and Hotchkiss, which we are situated along the same river, Paonia upstream, Hotchkiss downstream. But in those drugstores, we were ordering the anti-inflammatory chemicals, you know, for arthritis by the thousand. And yet I would go over to Gunnison to work, and the bottles on the shelf only came in 100 at a time, which made me realize that, and also while I was in Gunnison, I discovered that 89% of the babies that were born in the hospital over there developed what is called hyperbilirubinemia, jaundice. And, of course, the doctors just blamed it on the altitude. But what I noticed was that some of the babies that did not develop jaundice actually were born of mothers who lived in Ohio City, which is above Gunnison.
At a higher altitude.
The limestone ridge. And I thought, you know, their drinking water supply, like our drinking water supply over here in our valley where we live, is all surface water. It's all runoff water. And could our drinking water supply be the reason that we're seeing this unusual use of antiarthritics in the North Fork Valley and none in Gunnison, and why the babies being born over there were jaundiced? And that got me fascinated by what was going on, as well as having to irrigate my own farm, and got very concerned about water quality in the West.
And so as a result, you even went back to school and got a master's in ecology and then earned a PhD in zoology.
Yes.
And then you moved to Washington, D.C. and worked with the World Wildlife Fund. Tell us just a little bit about what that led to.
Actually, I went to Washington, D.C. on a congressional fellowship to work at the Office of Technology Assessment, where I was hoping we could generate enough interest to do for the OTA, the Office of Technology Assessment, to do a study on Western water quality. But that never materialized. And then I was contacted by a man who had seen my resume and said, would I be interested in working with him? And as it turned out, while working, I did go to work for him because it was a study about the state of the health of the Great Lakes.
Wow. Why were you studying the Great Lakes?
In 1972, if you remember, the Cuyahoga River caught on fire, and at that time, debris was building up on the shorelines of the Great Lakes. They were not very healthy looking. They were full of algal bloom, and top predator species around the lakes were beginning to disappear. There were no bald eagles actually reproducing on the shoreline of the Great Lakes anywhere by the time I was asked to do this study about the Great Lakes. So, of course, the bald eagle was a great animal to focus on. And as I began focusing on the other animals, the other top predator species in the lakes around the shoreline, I discovered that they were all having problems. And it looked like if an adult animal could reproduce, its offspring didn't survive. So this is why the populations were dwindling. Because the Great Lakes are such a wonderful place for water birds, aquatic species, to come in the summer to nest because of all its islands, isolated islands with no predators. Huge bird colonies would use these islands around the Great Lakes in the summer for nesting. And the wildlife biologists would go out and just see that half the eggs weren't hatching. If they did hatch, the chicks barely made it. And if the chicks should fledge the minute they take off and try to fly, they'd fly and drop dead. So, but each year, birds kept coming back. But by banding the birds, what they realized was that each year it was a new batch of new birds coming into the shoreline or around the on the islands from the much cleaner provinces and off the North Atlantic to use this area for nesting. So it was kind of like with the bald eagles, there weren't that many birds that could keep coming back because the bald eagles were disappearing across the country as well. Then we began looking at the fish species. But what it turned out to be was that, yes, the animals were having, populations were disappearing, the animals were having reproductive problems, and every bird and every fish that the wildlife biologist would biopsy and look at had abnormal thyroid glands. When they began testing their hormones, their thyroid levels were off. They noticed also that the male birds were growing oviducts and ovaries, basically developing female gonads. And a lot of the females were female-female pairing, not laying their own eggs, or if they did lay an egg, they all hang around and try to raise the egg themselves. It was a lack of parenting on a lot of the animals. They did not tend to the nest. The males especially would run off in rogue populations and stay away for days. And what that all meant was, and the animals, and very, very little cancer in the animals in the Great Lakes. Cancer was not causing their extirpation. What it was something was affecting the endocrine system. Because if you look at the effects, it seemed to be when the adult birds or the mothers pass through the egg or through their placenta, through their womb, to their offspring, these chemicals, then it was the chemicals in the offspring that were interfering with their development. Now, up to that time in the United States, the way we tested chemicals was on adult animals long after they had matured with high doses, looking for cancer, obvious birth defects, convulsions, the gross, obvious kinds of endpoints, and then determining that because at these high doses, they could extrapolate down and determine what would be a safe level. Never extrapolating down to what the concentrations would be in those little chicks or those fish or even in any human baby today. At the endocrine system operates with hormones at about a part per trillion or a part per billion. And what we are seeing is that now we have basically homed in on a lot of chemicals that at that concentration, that at ambient levels that we're exposed to today in the womb, they can alter how a baby mouse, a baby rat, a baby primate, whatever they're using, a rabbit in the laboratory, it can change how that individual develops.
This is William Evans. I'm speaking with Theo Colburn. She's telling about the effects of small doses of chemicals on the species in the Great Lakes. And this led her to understand the sensitivity the endocrine system has to synthetic chemicals.
Can I go back a minute?
Sure.
It was the animals around the shoreline of the lake that were picking up these chemicals. The chemicals, what the wildlife biologists did, they began working with chemists. These were large collaborative teams working together where they would actually measure, and the technology just became available about that time in the 70s and the 80s to be able to detect chemicals at parts per million. And so as they began to collect these animal species from around the shoreline that weren't doing well and measure the concentrations of the chemicals, what we call bioaccumulative chemicals, they were organochlorine chemicals, like the PCBs and dioxins and a lot of the chlorinated pesticides that you've heard over the years. These chemicals like fat, so they would build up in the fatty tissue.
So in 1996, you co-authored Our Stolen Future about the dangers of synthetic chemicals to the endocrine system.
Yes. Prior to that, in 1990, I was given the opportunity to bring together scientists from Europe, United States, to sit down and look at what they knew and their research based on the title of the meeting, which was Chemically Induced Alteration in Sexual and Functional Development, the Wildlife-Human Connection. Now,
wow.
Each one of these 21 people that I brought to the meeting work in a different discipline. Most of them had never heard of each other, let alone worked with each other. Some of the wildlife biologists knew each other because they were the ones who had been feeding me the data over the years to come to the conclusion that maybe these chemicals were affecting the embryo systems in all living organisms. But I didn't know whether anyone would believe me or not. So it was important to bring people like this together and listen to each other and see what they thought about this. And it was at that meeting, as the 21 scientists sat and listened to what the wildlife biologists had to say, to what the scientists at the National Institute of Environmental Health Science, the EPA, had to say about the work they were doing where they knew chemicals could affect alteration of the development of individuals and actually alter how they function later in life, causing chronic-type illnesses, not things that would kill you and maybe not openly capacitate you. Anyway, they sort of went through an epiphany when they sat and listened to each other and decided that they wanted to write a book. And each one of them contributed a chapter to a book coming from all the different angles about why chemicals could be affecting the endocrine system. The minute that technical book came out, the industry went for the jugular, believe me. You can go back and look at the literature. They tried to discredit the scientists. They're still trying to discredit the scientists who are doing this kind of research today. but there was a tremendous amount of pushback. And the problem was, how do you get this message out to the public? The press would not use it. The term endocrine disruption, you've never heard it probably on television until just very recently. It was a term that actually was coined at that meeting. And I'll tell you quite frankly, at that meeting, the only thing those scientists disagreed about was how we were going to call this thing, this phenomenon that they had sat there and discovered was taking place. So as a result of that, that book being out there and getting really nowhere with the press, and there was a lot of media control. Editors were told not to allow this material. Anything related to this just could not make it to the forefront in the news. So consequently, some foundations came to me. First, it was Pew, and said to me, we want you to write a popular press book. And they gave me 3 years of a fellowship to work on this, one of their Pew Scholars Fellowship. But I was having a real struggle with it and suddenly realized there was no way I could write a popular press book, not with the experience that I had. I contacted Pete Myers, who had funded a lot of my research and an excellent writer, and asked him if he would help me write the book. And he said yes. But it was after 6 months, neither of us were able to find the time to work with each other. So then I said to him, well, why don't we find a writer? And that's when I got Diane Dumanosky, a well-known journalist who had been a specialist in looking at environmental issues, to write the book. So she helped write this popular press book, which, when it came out in 1996, 2 months after it was out, Congress, in its effort to do something immediately, and was very concerned, but without really thinking what they were asking of EPA, told EPA to come up with, in 2 years, a set of screens and assays to be able to detect endocrine disruptors in the environment. Little did they know the burden they placed on the poor EPA. It was not prepared for this, and it never has been, and it's still not prepared because of all kinds of pressure. Pressure from industry, corporate control, just the lack of knowledge on the part of people who should be making these decisions. When EPA set up a panel to address this challenge, it was given that, actually it was a mandate by Congress to come up with a set of screens of assays. They did not invite one of the people who had been doing the endocrine disruption-like research that basically revealed what was going on. They were never allowed to attend the meeting. They did not speak there. I mean, it was a disgrace, a true disgrace.
It sounds familiar, Theo. We want to focus in our conversation with you today about the toxic chemicals used in the technology of natural gas extraction. What does toxic mean to you, Theo?
Toxic means to me that it's something that's harmful and can interfere with any natural or physical, chemical, developmental, or functional effect of tissue. I mean, it's a broad term. It's something that can interfere with what we deem now normal.
But it's a very clear term.
Warning symbol
for the universal warning symbol for toxicity is a skull and crossbones, the symbol of death.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, most of the studies that were done on the chemicals, and as we were looking very closely, I have a team working with me. We look at the studies that have been done that have evolved over the years looking at chemicals. Most of them were looking for acute kind of effects, something that would happen immediately. And that's why this is lost, because if a chemical gets into the developing embryo or fetus and, say, alters one little thing, say the development of the brain or bone, you name it, as that individual develops, everything that follows, everything that was upstream then towards becoming fully developed, is going to be undermined in some way. And because all of these vital systems are connected with each other, it can cause a whole cascade of events through one of the other systems, because none of our systems work alone. Everything's interconnected. So any kind of real disturbance very early on can lead to a a very sad situation. I mean, just picture a, you know, I hate to take bricks and mortar, but that's basically, think of us in terms of cells. And you build a building and you leave out a few bricks in some very critical places and you get the building built and it collapses. I mean, this, we know this. I mean, engineers, certainly architects understand this beautiful synchrony of thinking every building block, every step along the way when you're building a building to make sure it is very functional and safe. So many of the disorders that we're seeing today, like diabetes, obesity, autism, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, have now been traced back to and could very well be the result of prenatal exposure to chemicals. And keep in mind, remember that the endocrine system operates your thyroid hormone, your testosterone, estrogen, and many times in the body only operates at a part per trillion and even less. So if you've got a chemical that gets in the body during that particular stage of development that's very critical, and it happens to look like or slips into that receptor or turns on a certain enzyme or turns off an enzyme that is so important in producing the protein that's going to make that next cell develop, if you do something that early on, you're going to get into trouble.
This is William Evans. I'm speaking with Theo Colburn, and we're starting our conversation about the effects of oil and gas drilling in Garfield and Delta counties.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, because I quite inadvertently got involved with natural gas. There's a tremendous connection here between natural gas and what I've just been talking about that everyone needs to understand.
Carbondale is downstream and downwind from a nearby beautiful and economically important area referred to as the Thompson Divide. It's been leased for drilling, and based on what we see and can learn of what's happening to people and animals in the Rifle area, we're concerned about the adverse effects of drilling and fracking chemicals. Is that an appropriate concern?
Yes, I think it's valid, definitely. Just from the experience that people in Garfield County have had to go through, and others, you're watching the news, there's hardly a community near where natural gas activity has been taking place that someone isn't complaining about their health. Seems to be a growing, I would say, it's almost like a chorus coming from around the country. Where in the past drilling had not taken place near residential areas and that sort of thing, it is now, and I think that's why we're beginning to see more of these complaints.
What are you seeing and learning, Theo?
Well, one of the things we did at TEDx right away after I discovered that someone had suffered a very, very serious illness after drilling a well pad near her house, actually had already 8 or 9 wells on the pad, and many of the wells had been fracked 7, 8, 9 times. And she developed a very rare adrenal tumor, and prior to that, one of the chemicals that I know they were using in fracking had been linked with this kind of a tumor. And, of course, it was called an aldosterone tumor. And aldosterone is a hormone that controls blood pressure. When she called and told me that she had had to have her adrenal gland removed in order to get the cancer out, and that she had been breastfeeding her child during that whole 2-year period prior to discovering her tumor, I knew I was going to have to get involved. So that was the beginning, and we started collecting as much information, my staff and I, on any chemical or product. We would get the product, what are called material safety data sheets, that accompany the products that are being used for drilling and fracking, and also for use on the well pads. And it was through that that we began discovering that a lot of chemicals that were being used, they're not good. They're just not good for you, and you certainly don't want them in your drinking water.
Making life-sustaining choices includes the ability to recognize danger, the ability to protect an ecosystem, one's family, and oneself. I'm speaking with Theo Colburn. This concludes the first of our interviews with Theo. She told us while working on an environmental health assessment of the Great Lakes for the Canadian-U.S. International Joint Commission, Theo discovered 16 of the high-end predators at the top of the Great Lakes food web were in trouble. The females, through their eggs or through the womb, were passing to their offspring the persistent toxic chemicals accumulating in the mother's bodies. About that same time, women who ate Great Lakes fish were discovered to be passing the same chemicals to their offspring in the womb, which resulted in human developmental problems. In both wildlife and humans, endocrine systems were being attacked. As a result of these findings, Theo came to understand endocrine disruption. The endocrine system is extremely sensitive to foreign chemicals. Very small doses in parts per trillion can be significant and damaging. We've begun to converse about the effects of small doses of toxic chemicals used in oil and gas extraction, and we'll continue this subject in our next conversation. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.